I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Mikey Weinstein. He is president and founder of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, and he's author of the book No Snowflake in an Avalanche, The Military Religious Freedom Foundation, Its Battle to Defend the Constitution and One Family's Courageous War Against Religious Extremism and High Places. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Really appreciate it, Mary Charlotte. Thank you.
So you have a very proud and distinguished military background, and you yourself experienced religious discrimination when you were in the military. You're writing about what's happening today, but it does go way back. What was your own experience?
Right. My first book was called With God on Our Side, One Man's War Against an Evangelical Coup in America's Military. And that came out back in 2006 from St. Martin's in New York. And I talk more about the stuff at my alma mater, the Air Force Academy. I didn't really have a problem except for I had a very, other than a very serious thing that I thought was an anomaly when I actually got assaulted and knocked unconscious twice after receiving some notes under the door of my two roommates and a swastika on them and some other stuff. And then the Air Force allegedly, launched an investigation, never found who did it. It ended up with me. I struck an officer who accused me of doing it. I was 18 years old. I struck him. He went down. I ran back to my dorm room and waited to get shot, and nothing ever happened. So, that's kind of what went down.
So this was anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic behavior. Was that common? Did you see that among other Air Force people?
Not then. That was, there was nothing like that. It was not a systemic thing at that time, not at all.
And so what we have now, looking at your book, which is really, I have to say, I was reading this book, shaking my head, getting kind of mad. And I mean, we know that there is a lot of fundamentalist Christian political force in the right wing, but I really didn't know that it was that much of an integral part of the U.S. military, including the Air Force, which is where you're from. What does it actually look like? What's going on?
Let me ask you a question. Do you have a pen or a paper near you?
A pen or
an object that you can hold, say, 6 inches over your desk or table where we're broadcasting from?
Yes.
Okay, please hold it there. Now, would you drop it and let the listeners hear it hit?
That wasn't very loud, but there it was.
Why did it drop, Mary Charlotte?
Because of the force of gravity?
Right. That is exactly how ubiquitous and systemic, out of control, fundamentalist Christianity is inextricably intertwined with the technologically most lethal organization ever created by humankind, which is our United States military. We're not on the show today talking about a problem, issue, or challenge, Mary Charlotte. We're talking about a national security threat internally to this country, so enormous in magnitude, formidability, width, breadth, depth, whatever you want, that it's at least the same size as what we're facing externally by a resurgent Taliban and al-Qaeda, the Mujahideen, the terrorists, and the jihadists. It can be summed up in one sentence. We have a fanatical, out-of-control religiosity, and I'm not speaking about Wahhabist, fundamentalist Islam, the primarily Sunni and to a lesser extent Shia version, which we fight. I'm talking about what's called fundamentalist or dominionist Christianity mixed in with actual weapons of mass destruction. You see, we have them. The other side doesn't yet. Mixed in with a tortured, poisonous version of so-called patriotism, further mixed in with a completely unfettered access, Mary Charlotte, because of this, draconian specter of military command influence. The military is not IBM. It's very adversarial, communal, and ritualistic. Further mixed in with a complete dearth of any restraint, oversight, and supervision. And we have this. What you have is this national security threat that is so pernicious and so shocking that it's almost impossible to believe that it exists unless you're complicit.
It is really very difficult to believe that it exists and that it's so pervasive, partly because, and this is part of what your book is about, that the First Amendment explicitly prohibits that connection between church and state, and yet you give example after example after example in your book of people who lose their jobs, lose their careers, are beaten to a pulp because they refuse to become fundamentalist Christians within the military.
Correct. When you tell somebody that they lack integrity, character, courage, honor, honorability, trustworthiness, and general intelligence because of their chosen religious faith or lack thereof, why, Mary Charlotte, there's no difference between that and telling somebody that they're stupid because of the color of their skin or because they're a female. And in this instance, what we're talking about, you know, as I speak to you today, we have 27,282 active duty United States Marines, sailors, soldiers, airmen, cadets, and midshipmen at West Point, the Air Force Academy in Annapolis, some at the Merchant Marine Academy and Coast Guard Academy, National Guard, reservists, we have Coast Guard, and veterans who are our clients. And the real shocking thing for your listeners in Santa Fe, I hope their shoulder harness and seatbelts are on snugly, is that 96% of our clients are practicing Protestants and Roman Catholics, simply being persecuted for not being, quote, Christian enough. That 96%, by the way, breaks down to about 3/4 are Protestants of almost every denomination. As an example, we have 21 different denominations of Baptists alone, and the remaining 1/4 are Roman Catholic. The other 4% are Jewish, like I am, Buddhist, Hindu, atheist, agnostic, you know, Native American, spiritualist, Wiccan, whatever. We actually even have 12 adherents of the Jedi faith. I mean, don't ask. It's based on Star Wars, you know. This is something that, I mean, if you look at the cover of the book, it's very provocative. Our publisher somehow found a way to put three-dimensional blood on the cover of the book, and it's meant to be, the name, No Snowflake in an Avalanche, comes from the Voltaire quote, "No snowflake in an avalanche ever feels responsible." There's also a very excellent quote from Voltaire. There are so many, of course, he was a genius, that it is very dangerous to be right in matters upon which the established authorities are wrong.
So you have this fundamentalist, evangelical Christian strain within the military, and as I understand it, all branches of the military and filtering into the political system outside the military as well. What do they believe?
You know, it's interesting. Among basically what they want to do is to replace our democracy with a theocracy, and it's based on the very strict Levitican concept of the Ten Commandments. The problem is that there's no real a sense of even collegial acknowledgement and agreement as to which Ten Commandments we're talking about. But they are sure about one thing. The violation for all of them is death by stoning, you know, over and over again. Fundamentalist, or if you Google the term, Google it, Dominion Christians, basically have 4 or 5 very putrescent, shameful, disgusting stenches about them. And the first stench is virulent misogyny. You know, I mean, women are basically good for selecting food, preparing food, serving food, cleaning up after meals, and getting pregnant. The next, virulent homophobia, virulent Islamophobia, virulent anti-Semitism, and a virulent desire to subordinate what they view as flawed man's law, which is the U.S. Constitution. That should be subordinated to their pristine, weaponized gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm not on this show today. I'm not running for office. I don't care if anybody likes me. I've got the gun smoke in my face. My job is clear. It is not to put my hand to my chest and sing, "We shall overcome." It's to make a fist, raise it up, and make it clear that we shall come over. You know, our job is to afflict those who are comfortable and to comfort those who are afflicted. And our clients that come to us, most of them happen to be just, you know, Protestants or Roman Catholics, are basically spiritual rape victims from fundamentalist, dominionist Christians, religious predators as opposed to sexual predators.
So you're not talking about people, women, men, whatever, who've actually been raped, but you're talking about people. What are some examples? I mean,
we use many examples, you know, in our book, but in many respects, people have lost their promotions in the combat zone. They've been forced to into extremely dangerous combat situations because of their faith or their lack of faith. We've had 10 of our clients, KIA, if you're familiar with that term, killed in action in Afghanistan and Iraq. They've been denigrated, kicked to the side, marginalized. A person of color, what examples have you gone through? I mean, we talk about, as you know, they've been beaten, they've been denigrated, they've been made to feel less than human. And remember, in your military, in the U.S. military, it's very vertically encrusted. As I mentioned, very tribal, ritualistic. You know, it's an adversarial situation. It's in the civilian world. If you're being if you're being gently evangelized by your shift manager at Taco Bell or Starbucks, even that violates Title VII of the U.S. Code. But remember, the military has a completely separate legal system. If, for instance, having sexual intercourse with someone other than your spouse, adultery in the military, Mary Charlotte, is punishable as a felony. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
I've tried and defended those cases. In the U.S. military, if you're told by your superior to go to, you know, the base dentist at 4 p.m., and you don't go, it's a felony because it destroys good order and discipline. So if you're even being gently evangelized by your military superior, "Get the hell out of my face, sir or ma'am," is not an option for you. So they come to us, and just like Superman only has two weaknesses, kryptonite, and I'm told by my geek patrol, magic, the Pentagon, or as we call it, the Pentecostalgon, only has two weaknesses, exposure in the print and electronic media, like we're doing on this show right now, and secondly, being dragged into federal and state court. We do both with great regularity. We're militants. We're unabashed militants, but our militancy is in support of the Constitution. This is not a political spectrum left or right issue. It's a constitutional right and wrong issue. I'm a registered Republican. I just happen to be one who voted for Clinton twice, Gore, Kerry, and Obama. But I can tell you to an absolute certainty that Barry Goldwater would be spinning in his grave if he's seen what's happened to this current God's own party. I mean, it seems as though under Republicans, man exploits man, but under Democrats, it's just the opposite. So we've given up on both political parties because this is not a political issue. It's been politicized, you know, to the extent that you've seen this far fundamentalist, you know, extremist, we call weaponized gospel of Jesus Christ. And guys, go to our website, militaryreligiousfreedom.org, and you will see what Mary Charlotte has talked about. You'll see audio, you'll hear audio, you'll see video, you'll see pictures, you'll read stories. We're in the media somewhere every day. I've just been given my own column in the Washington Post, where I write now twice a month. Harper's Magazine has called me the constitutional conscience of the U.S. military. I don't say that for self-aggrandizement, but to let you understand that, you know, that we have something that is out of control here. And the people we're fighting, to answer your question, Mary Charlotte, will admit they're on this planet, but they really say we're not of this world. We might be here now. We're of the next world, and they'd like nothing better than to utilize our nuclear weapons to serve as an accelerant and or lubricant to bring their version of, like I said, warrior Jesus back here as quickly as possible. If you've read the book, I'm sure you've read chapter 14, which is, I think it's Nukes, Nazis, and Norway, about how we caught the Air Force about 8 months ago, infusing its training for U.S. Air Force nuclear missile launch officers, 68 of whom came to us begging for help, 62 of whom were Protestant or Roman Catholic. And, you know, the beat goes on. It never stops.
We're talking to Mikey Weinstein about his book, No Snowflake in an Avalanche. How did you come to start the Military Religious Freedom Foundation?
Anyone who has a child, whether it's biological, foster, adopted, it doesn't make a difference. When you see your children hurt, pretty much then, you know, your life is now forfeit. I have to really thank Mel Gibson for this, because when he came out with his famous movie, or I should say infamous movie, in February of 2004, I forget the name of it. I call it the Jesus Chainsaw Massacre or Freddy versus Jesus. I think it's called the Passion of the Christ.
Passion of the Christ,
I had my two sons and my future daughter-in-law, who's a Christian. My two sons are Jewish, at the Air Force Academy, and the incredible amount of pressure being put on the cadets there and the staff, about 10,000 people, to go see this movie made me realize what's happening here. So I started off as a pissed-off parent. For 8 or 9 months, I worked with my alma mater. Very hard I worked with them. I mean, I'm not an idiot. I've been around enough. I spent over 3 years in the West Wing of the Reagan White House as one of his lawyers, and I was White House counsel, and I was a general counsel to two-time presidential candidate H. Ross Perot. And I began to realize at some point that they were pissing in my face and telling me it was raining. So we went to war the latter part of 2004 to fight this, because it needs to be fought, and fought very, very hard with hammer and tongs.
Tell us about some of the specific cases. I mean, there are so many, but for example, there was
one that I didn't put in this book. A client of ours named David Winters, his father's a very well-known architect in the Washington, D.C. area. He didn't have the greatest high school career, but his father was never in, they happened to be a Jewish family, but was never in the Marines, but his father had a love for the Marine Corps. So when David graduated from high school a few years ago, he joined the Marines, went down to a place called Paris Island that you may have heard of, for Marine Corps training. And while he was down there, he found out immediately that the DIs, the drill instructors, didn't exactly like his religious faith. If any of you have seen the movie Full Metal Jacket, this is a situation where he was just being terrorized by Marine drill instructors. Their goal was to get him to renounce his Judaism and to accept Christianity. It's a fairly long program. I forget, it's 8-9 weeks or whatever it is down at these days down at Paris Island. David finally, he'd be doing push-ups, and they would kick the back of his head in, forcing his face down on the pavement, where his face would split like a ripe tomato. We had many first-hand accounts from his fellow Marines about the way he was essentially tortured. There was this overwhelming fundamentalist Christian tsunami, you know, sweeping through Marine Corps basic training like it is everywhere. He held out right to the end. And at the end, he finally renounced Christianity. He couldn't take it anymore. He renounced Judaism and accepted Christianity. He graduated, came home to see his delighted family, but he knew he had this burden on his mind. He didn't know what to do. He was very conflicted. He went for a walk with his dad, and I got a letter from him, you know, telling me about all this. That's the last thing he remembers before he stabbed his father to death 67 times. He went to trial. This was never brought up at trial. He's now in a in general population in a prison in suburban Maryland. We're trying to get him a new trial because he should be in a mental hospital. He completely broke. We've had many beatings happen, many. We've had clients of ours lose their wings if they're pilots, treasured wings they work so hard for, if they won't bow their head in a mandatory military formation. If we would find like a change of command or a promotion situation, if we could find a Jewish member of the military, Hindu, Buddhist, or Muslim that was forcing, or for that matter, atheist or agnostic, that was forcing their views on a helpless subordinate, we would fight them. But we don't. It's almost always the same thing. It's a, you know, it's a fundamentalist Christian that has basically taken their faith and ignored the fact that their personal fundamentalist Christian rights will always be trumped by their fellow American brother and sisters' civil rights. And by the way, I might add, they are civil rights. They're not civil privileges. You even get them if you're an asshole. Can we say asshole in the air? I'm not sure, but you get the point.
Well, how did it come to be this way? I mean, it wasn't that way when you were in the Air Force Academy in the 1970s. What happened?
We point back to the year 1972, and I'll tell you why. That was the year that we had the end of mandatory conscription, or the draft, because at least prior to that time, people were being involuntarily, you know, drafted into the military with some degree of equanimity, cognizable equanimity, from what we now refer to as, you know, as blue and red states. With the end of the draft in 72, we saw the so-called all-volunteer army. Now, there's still a poverty draft, I can assure you, right? But how many rich people or members of Congress have their kids in the military? Not many. And we saw this migration of people that decided to volunteer, coming mostly now from what we refer to as red states. And we saw this fusing of super, you know, American exceptionalism and supremacy, patriotism, with this extreme fundamentalist Christianity that America should be based on the concepts of the new, of the, you know, they'll grudgingly say Judeo-Christian, but they mean, you know, this version of the New Testament that focuses on such passages as Luke 19:27, which is called the parable of the pounds. But in the hands of the fundamentalists, you know, when Jesus does say this, he tells a story and says, go out among the people and bring back before me, Jesus, all those that will not accept me, Jesus, as king over them, and then slaughter them in front of me. Yes, it actually says that. They love that. They love that. And in the meantime, is after 1972, it started to grow and grow and grow ever more perceptibly. And then by the end of 1994, at the end of the second year of the first Clinton term, we saw the real politics of ugly politics rear their heads, the politics of polarization when Newt Gingrich took over as the Speaker of the House, the Contract for America. In other words, you were a true American. It was very digital. If you followed these specific guidelines, you know, women have no choice in abortion. We want no gun control. You know the whole situation.
Right.
And then if you don't follow these, you don't really deserve to be an American. And then it went on for another 7 years, and then on 9/11, it went out of control, even more so than ever. And they view the world they're ideologues, and there's tremendous anti-intellectualism there, just like with Pol Pot and in Cambodia. You're not supposed to think, because when you're an ideologue, Mary Charlotte, well, you know, your ideology thinks for you. But it's bad enough if this was in the Santa Fe school district, or the police, or the sanitation workers, or the firefighters. But we have this out-of-control fundamentalist end-times Armageddon craziness at epic proportions, where all of our nuclear weapons, conventional weapons, and laser-guided weapons are. And it's terrifying.
And so the danger is that some of these people who are essentially members of an extremist cult who are running, as you say, the weapons of mass destruction that have more power than any other set of weapons in the whole world, these people have their hands on nuclear triggers? What I mean?
No, stop there. Yes, you're correct. And it's not just a cult. You have to remember, we think it's somewhere between 28% to 32% of the U.S. military are made up of these maniacs. That may sound like it's not much, but Hitler only had 7.9% in his National Socialist movement, and guess what? Stalin had 2.9% in his movement. And remember, when you graduate from like the Air Force Academy as the lowest level of an officer, you know, what's called an O-1 or second lieutenant, that on that day you already outrank 80% of the U.S. Air Force, because most of it's enlisted. It's even higher percentages at for the Marine Corps and Navy out of Annapolis and the Army out of West Point. So, you know, there's a reason we are New Mexico's only organization that has ever been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. We actually have four Peace Prize, Nobel Peace Prize nominations. We had two for 2010. It's given out in Oslo each year, you know, in the month of October. And then we had one for 2011. We lost in 2011, but that was the heaviest nomination year, Mary Charlotte, ever for the Peace Prize. And only 54 organizations worldwide were nominated, so we were thrilled. Even though we lost a week later, we got nominated again for this year. We'll find out in October whether we win it or not, this time by a prior winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. So
very interesting. We're talking to Mikey Weinstein about his book, No Snowflake in an Avalanche. What do you see if these people are allowed to run rampant, and you're fighting it very hard, and I think it's very important that people know about this, because it seems very dangerous. What do you see as the most dire possible scenario?
Nuclear war. I mean, they are thrilled with what's happening between Israel and our country and Iran right now, and there's absolutely no question about what they want. This type of civil rights fighting, we don't even say activism anymore. We're fighters. We have about just under 90 people in the foundation. You know, we're headquartered in Albuquerque, but we have our research department in New Jersey. Our promotions and web and PR folks and lawyers are in L.A. as well as San Francisco and Topeka and Dallas. We're all over the country, but we know that this is, this is very lonely, very dangerous, and very expensive. The book, No Snowflake in an Avalanche, which, again, you can get on our website at militaryreligiousfreedom.org or on Amazon or at Barnes & Noble, but the website is the fastest way to get the book. This details everything that's there. I mean, in our house in Albuquerque, we've had the windows shot out of our house twice. We've had animals slaughtered and put on the front porch of the house. We've had swastikas and crucifixes painted on the house, tires slashed, you know, beer bottles and feces thrown at the house. That's just here. We're armed all the time. We have our own bodyguards. They'll be with us at Collected Works. We have attack-trained dogs. And we probably average on a normal week somewhere between 8 to 12 fairly grotesque death threats. It's not uncommon when I'm on the road we can get 50, 60, or 70. This is not, you know, like, I don't know how to describe it. Riding a unicorn through a cotton candy forest, you know, handing out, Mary Charlotte, lollipops to little forest animals that are singing in unison in English. This is blood sport. Blood sport. They want nuclear war. Do you understand?
I mean, it seems to me that they are mentally ill.
It seems to them that we are mentally ill. When you want to take this kind of fight on, you better be prepared to be, you know, kicked to the curb and abandoned and betrayed by many friends and even family. This is one of those situations where you have to be prepared not only to bite the hand that feeds you, but to bite your own arm off if you want to get into this fight. And there's lots of other organizations. People for the American Way, the Southern Poverty Law Center, Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, the ACLU, but none of them, Mary Charlotte, focus with laser-like precision where all the weapons are. We're the only organization that does this. You know, everything sounds better, right, in Latin. You know, there's a quaint phrase, quis custodiet ipsos custodos. Who will guard the guards? Well, the guardians of our precious constitutional freedoms are our members of the military. And apparently the only organization guarding them about this is the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. So we go 24/7, 365, or in a year like 2012, 366, because it's a leap year. And this is all happening right here in New Mexico. We keep a pretty low profile here. But, you know, when we go out all over the country, it's quite a different situation. And this is something that I'm hoping that people will listen to this show and consider coming out on Thursday. I think it's 6 p.m. to Collected Works, where I'll be giving a speech, signing the book, and talking more about this in a way that, I'm not going to be happy until you leave my speech unhappy, because you actually have to give a crap about this. It's not like I don't care about the starvation and violence in Darfur, or, you know, the HIV crisis in sub-Saharan Africa, or global warming, or the whales. But if we lose this fight, we lose everything. We lose the planet.
Well, I mean, let's get back to this. They are delighted about the prospect of nuclear war, which really has the potential.
Let me stop you right there. Let me make sure you can understand it. They're more than delighted. They are promised. They, meaning dominionist fundamentalist Christians, they'll talk about this at their fundamentalist churches very, very proudly. They're promised a 200-mile-long river. Rob Parsley, the head of the World Harvest Church in Columbus, regales us all the time. 4.5 feet deep. picture this now, filled with nothing but the human blood of those that their version of weaponized Jesus is slaughtered at the Battle of Armageddon. Oftentimes, Rod Parsley, as an example, the leader of this movement, will then tell his 11,000 congregants, therefore, rejoice, rejoice, my brothers and sisters, for the worst is yet to come.
I get back to the mentally ill piece, because this is a kind of, I mean, I cannot see it as anything but a kind of madness.
But remember that there's the old saying that any sufficiently advanced incompetence, Mary Charlotte, is completely indistinguishable from malice. You know, if the doctor doing your gallbladder surgery is drunk and takes out the wrong organ in your body, internal organ, you know, he doesn't have the specific intent to do violence because he's drunk, but it doesn't make a difference to your body. In this case, we have a situation where we have docile, supine, you know, Homer and Marge Simpson America, most of whom are far more concerned about what's happening, you know, on Jersey Shore or Dancing with the Stars or what is Kim Kardashian doing. It's something that we're faced with all the time. We often find that liberals are not our best donors. Our best donors tend to be conservative people that don't want people to know they're donating to us, but they see the terror. It's just amazing. So we put it in a book. I don't know if you read the whole book, but my publishers decided at the end of the book to put in some of the most horrendous, wretched, filthy, hideous letters and emails that we get, along some of the really good ones. And they're in there, and they're hard to read. But, you know, when you it was several years ago, we had a Native American, a Navajo from New Mexico, a U.S. Navy sailor on a very large aircraft, nuclear aircraft carrier, send us a brief email just saying, I want to thank you very much, Mikey and Military Religious Freedom Foundation, because you are the voices that we're not allowed to speak with. Small number of words, but that makes you realize what, you know, why we're doing what we're doing. We have at any one time about a dozen of our clients that are on the verge of suicide. We have them on a suicide watch. We just had one last week that attempted suicide. More often than not, they're Protestant or Roman Catholic. They're not used to it. I mean, I'm Jewish, so therefore I know what it, and I grew up in New Mexico. I know what it's like to be a minority. But if you're Episcopalian or Lutheran or Methodist or Baptist or Assemblies of God, Presbyterian, you're not used to it. Roman Catholic, you're not used to this. You're not used to being told that you're worthless. You're nothing.
It must be even worse for women soldiers.
It is. But remember I said it's you know, there's a tremendous amount of misogyny.
Yeah.
That is just almost hard to believe. I have to say, I've been interviewed, if not hundreds, several thousand times. You're great. I'm enjoying this. You ask great questions.
Thank you.
Let me give you a case. It takes a second or two to talk about it. I'm going to have to use abbreviations, because there isn't that much time, but it shows you how poignant and powerful this is. Several years ago, and remember, we have 27,282 cases. We talk about a lot of them in the book, No Snowflake and an Avalanche, and come out on April 12th at 6 p.m. at Collected Works, and I'll stay there as long as it takes. I received a phone call on a Saturday afternoon about 4 years ago from a battle-hardened U.S. Army non-commissioned officer. He was calling from Iraq. And he was stationed in a part of Iraq that you may have heard of called Sadr City, ruled by a man named Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi army. It's about 2.5 million people, a very violent part of Baghdad. He was weeping. He told me, Mr. Weinstein, the story starts 6 weeks earlier. And so he tells me the story. He's part of a fire team. His job is to go out into a certain part of Sadr City, wherever there's just been an IED explosion or RPG explosion, that's rocket-propelled grenade, or a suicide bombing, and try to calm the populace, let them know it's okay, the Americans are here, and we're going to make everything better. So 6 weeks ago, he goes out. He describes how hard it is because the dust is so fine in the air that after there's been an explosion like this, it's so fine it merges with pieces of skin and organs and the bones of those that have been blown to bits so that there's like a red haze out there. It was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so you're breathing in this red dust that is actually included with the particulate of the poor victims that have been out there. He looks off to the side and he sees a little boy who's probably 7 years old screaming inconsolably, Ahmed, 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 Ahmed. He runs over and the little boy, it looks like he's covered in strawberry jam. What he's covered in is what's left of his little street brother, Ahmed. There are a lot of little children that have been abandoned in Sadr City because their parents have been killed or run off by the war. And this little boy's name was Muhammad. Make a long story short, The sergeant befriends him, takes him back to his fire base, although he's not supposed to be allowed to stay on the base or sleep overnight. He becomes like a second father to Muhammad. He wants him to forget the horrific horrific experience of watching Ahmed, who bore the brunt of that blast. That happened to be a suicide bombing that day. It was because Ahmed bore the brunt that Muhammad was relatively unscathed. The sergeants from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where I just gave a speech a few days ago, and one of our largest military bases, he calls his wife up and says, "How would you feel about adopting Muhammad?" They already have two kids. The wife wasn't too keen on it at first, but then she thought it was a good idea. Speaking of not too keen, you know, the Pakistanis, Afghans, and they don't like to be called Afghanis, by the way, but Afghans, and the Iraqis aren't really big on Americans adopting their kids, but the sergeant was trying to go through the process of doing it. Flash forward to today, the day he's calling me. And remember, he's still weeping on the phone. This was his third combat tour. He was heavily decorated. He gets the call about an hour and a half ago to get back out to Sadr City. Again, it's on in the afternoon, and he, in the pit of his stomach, he feels terrible because he knows that Muhammad did not spend that night with him on the military installation. You following me, Mary Charlotte?
Yeah.
So they get out in their trucks. They go out to almost the same part where it was 6 weeks ago, and there's that same red particulate in the air where, you know, the dust has fused with the blood, the bone, the organs, and it's horrific. To look at it's horrific, to smell it's horrific, and then he sees the thing that was terrifying him the most. There's Muhammad on a street corner, almost an exact repeat again, screaming inconsolably, "Ahmed, Ahmed, Ahmed." The sergeant does the unthinkable. He drops his weapon and just runs over as quickly as he can to be with the little boy. He sees no injuries on him, but the little boy is screaming, the snot in his nose, his tears, the sweat is merging together. He rips off the clothes because oftentimes the shrapnel, this time, by the way, it was an IED explosion. The shrapnel can go into the body very small but come out very large. He turns the boy upside down. There's nothing on him. He notices the little boy has a piece of paper in his right hand, but he's screaming over and over again, "Ahmed, Ahmed, Ahmed." So all the last 6 weeks has been ruined because all the little boy is thinking about is what happened before 6 weeks ago. The sergeant screams for an Iraqi interpreter to come over who can speak Arabic. And he screams to the interpreter to ask Muhammad, you know, what happened. The interpreter asks him something. His eyes get huge, and he points to the little boy's hand. And the sergeant grabs out of his hand a piece of paper, and the interpreter's face turns white. The little boy is still screaming. And do you know what was on that paper, Mary Charlotte? It was a cartoon. It was a four-panel, four-color cartoon made up of four cells. In the first cell, it shows a clearly Arabic man walking shoulder to shoulder down a street in an Arabic country, because the street signs are all in Arabic. Could have easily have been Sadr City in Baghdad in Iraq. So the soldier is in his battle dress uniform walking next to an Arabic man in Arabic garb. In cell number two of the four-cell cartoon, there is an explosion like an RPG, IED, or suicide bombing. In the third cell, it shows the American soldier, who's obviously been killed, in his battle dress uniform sitting at the right hand of Jesus. Jesus is on a throne. And in cell number four, it shows the Arabic man burning eternally in a column of flame. There's Arabic lettering underneath each one. The sergeant suddenly understands that Muhammad has been able to read this, and now he knows, Muhammad knows, where Ahmed is. He's burning eternally in that fire, the flame, column of flame. But we're not done yet. That's the rest of the story. The sergeant is infuriated. He screams for the interpreter to ask Muhammad, where did he get that? Where did he get that cartoon? Muhammad says something to the interpreter. The interpreter's face turns completely white again. He turns to the 6 o'clock position and points with his hand. And about 26, 27, 28 yards away is the West Point graduate company commander, an Army U.S. captain, the commander of the sergeant, who's handing out those cartoons to as many Iraqis as he possibly can at the scene of the explosion. End of story.
We're talking to Mikey Weinstein about his book, No Snowflake in an Avalanche. I have to say that I can't help but think that these Christian fundamentalist fanatics and their Muslim fundamentalist fanatic counterparts, yeah, they kind of have a lot in common.
Well, they do, except for one thing. We refer to the people we're fighting as the Christian Taliban. But you see, fundamentalist Muslims are very, very, they're totally... totally fine. They're totally down with and totally motivated to both kill and die for their fanatical fundamentalist faith. Fundamentalist Christians are totally down and totally cool, and they're totally all about killing for their faith. They're not too keen to die for it.
And so I suppose that makes them vulnerable to some extent.
Well, we know one thing they're vulnerable to. They're vulnerable to people standing up and fighting, you know, but it's as Martin Luther King said, you know, in the end, Mary Charlotte, we remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. And there comes a time when silence becomes betrayal. So to everyone who's listening to this broadcast today, stop and think. You know, we're men and women, boys and girls. We're American citizens. We're supposed to give a crap about each other. It's not just about saving for your 401k. And it's not just about helping out with this charity or going to Little League. You know, I mean, you need to be aware of this, and we actually have to do something now. The most powerful force on planet Earth, with the greatest number of nuclear weapons, to say nothing about the conventional weapons, and we mentioned earlier the laser-guided weapons, you know, it's been completely corrupted, you know, by this fundamentalist Christian tsunami, the Christian Taliban. I only have two board members. One of them lives in Santa Fe, Ambassador Joe Wilson. His wife, Valerie Plame Wilson, very dear friends. They've been supporting us for years. We have a large advisory board, which includes former state governors and ambassadors and generals and actors, Mike Farrell from the TV show MASH, Ed Asner, others, you know, that are huge supporters. But this is something that nobody has ever seen before. When people see it, politicians don't want to touch this in any way, shape, or form. Doesn't make a difference whether they're Democrats or Republicans. We've been kicked to the curbs by Democrats in the state of New Mexico and by Republicans. You know, this isn't that kind of an issue. It's not an issue at all. It's a national security threat. And, you know, people often ask, you know, what is it that you really want, Mike? And, I tell them that what we want is we want constitutional equanimity back here again. We want a level playing field. And we have a beautiful constitution in this country. Israel has no constitution. Many countries don't. But in this country, our constitution separates temporal, you know, metaphysical and physical, temporal and spiritual, church and state for a very good reason. Our constitutional founding framers, you know, looked assiduously at European history, Mary Charlotte, where most of the horrors that had occurred had been when men of the cloth had been men in political power. They looked at Cromwell in England, and they looked at the Salem witch trials, and they said, not here. We're not going to do that here. We are a secular republic where all faiths are allowed to be gloriously and comprehensively and universally practiced as long as they don't engage the machinery of the state, the awesome financial power, heft, and prestige of our government, particularly our U.S. military, to gain an insuperable advantage over any other faith. We don't allow that here. Also, it's not just the First Amendment, which the religious right, you know, views as a myth, like Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster. There's also Clause 3, Article 6 of the Constitution, which was passed when the body of the Constitution was passed in December of 1789, a full 15 months before the Bill of Rights was passed, you know, in March of 1791, which, by the way, that was passed not for the convenience of the majority, but to protect the minority from the expected tyranny of the majority. When you stand up to a military superior in this Army, Air Force, or Navy, or Marine Corps, you often find that the tyranny of the majority morphs into the tantrum of the majority. So that's why they come to us. But
now,
Clause 3, Article 6 says no religious test, no religious test in this country. You wanted a piece of information? How about this one? Tuesday, July 12, 2005, on the front page of the newspaper, most despised by the Pentagon, the Air Force makes an announcement. So you know it had to be fully vetted. What would that newspaper be? It's not the Santa Fean. It's the New York Times. The Air Force announces 7 years ago, you know, and come this July, that it will now reserve its right to evangelize anyone it, the United States Air Force, determines to be, quote, unchurched. So I guess the Air Force, as along with the other branches of the military, will hold a religious Geiger counter up to anyone. And if it comes back and says this amorphous thing called unchurched, while the military reserves the right not to Catholicize or mainline or, you know, mainline Protestantize or Buddhize or Hinduize or atheize or agnosticize or Judaize or Islamicize you, they reserve the right to evangelize you.
Now, tell us about some of the cases that you've won.
Well, we just won one. We just had it. It's all over the news. We had the Air Force's professional military education for its captains had announced for the last 8 years in their mandatory reading, making it clear to officers that unless they attended chapel, they would be viewed as morally lax, and the only way they could be moral would be to attend chapel, which means they want to get you into Baskin-Robbins, and once you're there, they'll tell you which of those 31 flavors you should go with. Our lawyers, we have 8 law firms that work for us, including one of the largest ones, international law firms in the world, Jones Day. We sent a letter in March 27th on behalf of 61 of our clients, 41 of whom were Protestant or Roman Catholic. Within 24 hours, they pulled the training. We've had this happen on many, many occasions. But oftentimes, this is like weed whackers. It beats back the you know, the Christian Taliban for a week or two, and then they come back again. It's beyond the scope of this show to go into so many of our other stories. They're in the book. They're on the website again, everybody, militaryreligiousfreedom.org. And the book is No Snowflake in an Avalanche. And, you know, please come out to Collected Works. I know it's a Thursday, 6 p.m., and we'll sit down and get into this even more significantly.
Tell us about the fellow who was refused both his rabbi and then eventually refused treatment in a VA hospital because he was Jewish.
Right. This is Akiva David Miller, a wonderful decorated career in the U.S. Navy. I mentioned we have many veterans who are clients of ours. He's now our veterans director. He was born into a fundamentalist Christian family, later converted to Orthodox Judaism. When he went into an extremist, a medical extremist, into a VA medical facility, hooked up to life-saving heart monitoring machines, in comes the VA chaplains, telling him that he needs to accept Jesus immediately. He's struggling to even form his words to tell him to get the hell out of the room. They won't go. But this happens a lot. It happens a lot. The concept is that the people we're fighting, the Christians we're fighting, follow the Great Commission, which says one of the last things Jesus is supposed to have said to his disciples, denoted in Mark 16:15 and Matthew 28:19, go and make disciples of all nations. And he fought as hard as he could. We had to come in to help him with this. And he credits us with saving his life. And now he handles all of our Veterans Affairs for us and does it magnificently. We have so many of our clients that have been so heavily decorated in combat. But, you know, they come back, they don't have a voice. And in the military, if you're having your civil rights savaged like this, there are only four or five things that you can do, and all of them have been corrupted. So they come to us because, like, as I mentioned earlier, nature abhors a vacuum. You know, I did an interview with Dan Rather a couple of years ago, and I was a little wary of it because I know he always has kind of a zinger question, but we went for like 3 hours. They cut the interview down so it's shown on TV, but it's like 23, 24 minutes, still a pretty long interview. It was a great interview, and he was totally understanding what we were talking about, and then came the zinger question at the end. He said, you know, Mikey, you and your family and your foundation, the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, are often criticized because you're fighting the Pentagon at the same time that you've criticized being unpatriotic because you're fighting the Pentagon at the same time that we're involved in two overt and one covert war, the covert war at the time being Pakistan. How do you respond to that? You know, Mary Charlotte, you often come up with these pithy responses, you know, a day, you know, 2 weeks later or whatever, but this time I was ready. And I said, and this is how we actually ended the interview. I said, you know, Dan, I don't have to come up with a response as to what how we respond to charges of being unpatriotic, because the late, great, very recently late, great historian Howard Zinn did it for me. Now, you may remember Mary Charlotte. He wrote the book, A People's History of the United States,
yeah.
You know, from the perspective of women, Native Americans, African Americans, you know, trade union people, totally different history that we were taught in the schools. And I said, you know, Dan, Professor Zinn's statement he taught at Boston University was that dissent is the highest form of patriotism. And that's where we are.
We're talking to Mikey Weinstein about his book, No Snowflake in an Avalanche. What is your hope for the work of the foundation and others who support you?
We want 300. We want about 300 people to be court-martialed, to face trial by general court-martial in the military, because I'll say this, the Romans had it right. When you cut off somebody's head, stick it on a pole, and show it to the masses, it changes behavior. At this point, people are only being promoted when we catch them. Of course, they're being embarrassed, but this is what the military likes. Unless you stand up, remember what Frederick Douglass said, the great abolitionist. Power concedes nothing, Mary Charlotte, without a demand. So our foundation, the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, that's what we do. We're the demanders of the commanders because nobody else can do it.
But, I mean, if you have, as you had said before, 28 to 32% of the military, which admittedly is very high, being these evangelical, fundamentalist, nuclear war-mongering, Jesus's army, whatever kind of oxymoron that might be, that means that another approximately 70% of them aren't that way.
That's right, but you have to understand, have you ever been in the military?
No.
Anybody in your family ever been in the military?
Yeah.
Okay, ask them, because it's a hierarchical, vertically encrusted organization. You know, it doesn't. You know, most of the people are junior ranking. Most of our clients are junior officers and junior NCOs. I don't know if you know the difference between an NCO and an officer. Most of America doesn't. And that's, you know, I don't think the ACLU does. That's why they come to us. So the bottom line is, if you get the leaders and you punish them and make examples of them, people will understand. Just like you can't use the N-word anymore for African Americans. You can't grab certain parts. You can't sexually harass women. At least you're not supposed to be able to. But it all comes down to enforcement. If you don't enforce, you know, if you drive 110 miles an hour between Santa Fe and Albuquerque, and you're not concerned about the New Mexico Highway Patrol because they're not there, well, then there's nothing to stop your behavior.
But are you saying that the people at the top of the hierarchy, the generals and the people at the very top of the military hierarchy, are all fundamentalist Christian nuclear war-wanting warmongers, more or less?
Not all of them at all, but enough of them are. And remember, you know, either they're, you know, they're either acts of malfeasance or misfeasance. They see what's going on, but they're terrified to do anything. They're terrified it'll hurt their careers. They're terrified for their jobs, their families. They're terrified for their lives. In many respects, they sit and they look the other way, hoping that nobody will see anything. And if we're not talking fundamentalist Christian Jim Crow, we're talking fundamentalist Christian fascism.
Mikey Weinstein is president and founder of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. The book is called No Snowflake in an Avalanche. He will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Thursday, the 12th of April at 6 in the evening. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. And again, for anyone who wants to see more, just go to the website, militaryreligiousfreedom.org. Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.